From the studios of Wavefront Audiovisual Engineering in Schenectady, New York, this is Little Brother, the show where we talk about high technology, low intelligence, crime, greed, corruption, and all of the wonderful things that happen when you mix them together. Like any responsible little brother, we tell on Big Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter, and I'll be your host as we explore this world of the high tech. This is episode 90 of Little Brother for the 25th of June, 2022. Stay tuned. Little Brother is right around the corner. As always, I'd like to remind everyone that the opinions and views expressed in this program are strictly those of the participants and not necessarily those of anyone else who may, for whatever reason, attempt to claim them. Responsible parties with an opposing viewpoint may request an opportunity for a rebuttal. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can write me at critter@littlebrotherpodcast.com. So, let's get started. Cloudflare is a content distribution network and a provider of DDoS prevention services. Most of the time, when you surf the net, your web browser connects to one such provider, which then acts as your proxy to the website you're actually trying to reach. This prevents big crushes of traffic from knocking sites offline, an event often called slash dotting, named for the website that was most often responsible for such events. Well, on Tuesday, Cloudflare had an outage, taking down with it a significant chunk of the internet. In an amusing display of irony, the Cloudflare outage took out Down Detector, a website whose purpose is to help you figure out if a website is down or if it's a problem on your end. Security researchers Matilda Beckendahl, Miro Haller, and Kenneth G. Peterson have written a paper demonstrating a collection of different attacks that can be used to access encrypted content held on cloud storage service Mega. Cleverly named the Malleable Encryption Goes Awry paper, spelling out Mega, the body of research doesn't just explain the attacks, but actually brings the receipts by demonstrating proofs of concept of each. For their part, Mega have patched against one of the attacks, however, to my knowledge, the remainder are still viable. The obvious mitigation measure for this, if your content is truly sensitive, is to apply your own layer of encryption prior to sending any content to Mega. This advice, of course, generally applies equally well to all cloud storage services, encrypted or not. The European Commission has been making some noise lately about what they are calling chat control. This should sound very familiar to anyone who's been fighting the cryptography fight, as I have been for decades now. In essence, the EU would like to have the ability to crack open the encryption on encrypted chat platforms and look at what's inside, with the primary stated goal of, you guessed it, protecting the children. It seems as though the German federal government, however, is not having it. They have sent the European Commission a list of 61 questions. While many of the questions are legal technical in nature, that is, seeking an understanding of the legal language, the questions otherwise are focused on the efficacy of the idea and are holding the EU's feet to the fire to get them to square this with the privacy and legal rights of European citizens. It should surprise nobody to hear this, but a recent report from Microsoft confirms it. The Russian government is running a global cyber influence operation to support the war in Ukraine. It would be glib to say that this is from the Russian playbook. The truth is that this is from the global powers playbook. Russia just happens to be one of them. PsyOps and influence ops are a natural part of any armed conflict, and hence the saying that the first casualty of war is the truth. Slapping a cyber in front of it says nothing about the tactics, just the terrain. Related to that, the U.S. Department of Justice has detected a botnet run by Russian operatives and dismantled it. The botnet, dubbed RSOX, was made up of millions of hacked Internet of Things or IoT devices. Sadly, this is an ongoing concern with IoT, largely because devices often outlive the vendor's willingness to keep the systems patched. A security camera, a washing machine, a router, smart light bulb, whatever, might, depending on its usage pattern, have a lifespan of a decade or more, while the vendor may have only budgeted and planned for 3 to 5 years of usage, making it impossible to patch your systems. And those are the headlines. You're listening to Little Brother. Well, here we are again. It's time for another round of Who Got Pwned This Week. This week's winner is Beanstalk Farms. Beanstalk Farms is a distributed finance operation whose goal is to balance the supply and demand of cryptocurrencies. Beanstalk Farms' governance is carried out by vote. However, instead of being one person, one vote, it is, like many corporate entities, one share, one vote. People who control the shares, or tokens as they are called in this context, can also make proposals to be voted on. Do you see the loophole here? Somebody did. It seems as though an individual took out a flash loan. That's a loan whose term is on the scale of minutes or even seconds, used the loan proceeds to buy up enough tokens for a majority, created a proposal to give themselves all of Beanstalk Farms' assets, and then used their majority to vote in favor. The payout was then used to pay back the loan. Guys, this is why corporations have lawyers to work out these things. Senator Ed Markey, a Democrat from Massachusetts, is making some noise about the audio capabilities of Ring doorbells. His concern is that the audio capabilities likely record millions of Americans' activity without their knowledge every day. This surveillance system, he writes in a letter to Amazon, threatens the public in ways that go far beyond abstract privacy invasion. Individuals may use Ring devices' audio recordings to facilitate blackmail, stalking, and other damaging practices. The EFF has, if you will pardon the pun, echoed the concerns to Amazon. Meanwhile, in the UK, a judge ruled late last year that such cameras around a communal parking area constituted a violation of the Data Protection Act. Oh, if only we had such judges here. I've given this a little bit of thought, and while I want to emphasize that I am not a lawyer, I do see a few legal issues here with Ring cameras capturing audio, and these are issues I probably wouldn't have even given a second thought to had the gentleman from Massachusetts not raised them. The first of these issues concerns state laws around recording audio. As a general rule, the many states are often designated as one-party or two-party consent states. The two-party consent is sometimes more accurately called all-party consent. So in a one-party state, such as New York, you can record a conversation or a phone call as long as at least one person in the conversation is aware that they are being recorded and has consented. I can, for instance, enter a room with a live mic and record all I want as long as I am there, because that mic will record anything that I say or do as well. And I would hope that if I am holding a live mic, I've consented to doing so. Certainly, legally, it's considered so. In a two-party state, such as, well, Markey's own, Massachusetts, there's a need to secure consent from everyone being recorded before you can record them. But the problem with Ring doorbells is the possibility that nobody there has consented to the recording. That's a live mic that I've brought into a room and then left the room. That, to my layman's understanding of the law, isn't permitted even in a one-party consent state. That's a problem. Here's another. Many of these devices connect using one or another manner of unlicensed radio, such as Wi-Fi. Most unlicensed radio is regulated by the Code of Federal Regulations, Title 47, Part 15, including Wi-Fi. Why is this important? Listen to this passage. Quote, "Except for the operations of law enforcement officers conducted under lawful authority, no person shall use, either directly or indirectly, a device operated pursuant to the provisions of this part for the purpose of overhearing or recording the private conversations of others, unless such use is authorized by all of the parties engaging in the conversation," end quote. That is 47 CFR, Section 15.9. It basically is saying if you are using an unlicensed radio-connected device to listen in, you are in two-party territory by federal law. So yeah, I think there's a problem here. It's a problem that I think needs addressed, and I would applaud the efforts of Senator Markey and of the Electronic Frontier Foundation to address them. It pains me to bring it up on this podcast, but it would be negligent of me not to talk about what happened yesterday, but probably not for the reason you believe. Yesterday, for those who have been living under a rock, the Supreme Court of the United States overturned Roe v. Wade, a 1973 decision upholding the right to abortion. Let me be clear, I'm not here to talk about abortion. Whatever stance you have on that, that's your business, that's up to you. But I do want to talk about some of the other implications of this ruling, and they should concern you whichever way you lean. For starters, the original Roe decision was based on the idea that people have a constitutional right to privacy. Some of the suggestions about other rulings that may be next in the crosshairs suggest that it is not just abortion itself, but the actual right to privacy that the court is not buying. This is a problem. As it stands right now, we are over-surveilled. We carry a tracking device in our pockets everywhere we go. It emits a beacon to connect itself to a nationwide, or indeed worldwide, network of cell towers and Wi-Fi access points that not only keep us connected to the world, but provide a constant update of our whereabouts. We use applications on our devices, our phones, our computers, our game consoles, our televisions, our set-top boxes, which already gather way more information than we have any reason to be comfortable with. The corporations that gather this information, search giants like Alphabet, better known as Google, social media giants like Meta, known for Facebook and Instagram, software giants like Microsoft, and many, many others gather up this information and they use it to decide who you are and what they can sell you. Let me emphasize that last point. None of this is nefarious. They just want to sell you things, and keep you engaged so that they can sell you more things. Unfortunately, the fact that it is not nefarious doesn't make it not dangerous. Surely, it's a familiar idea for a friend or a family member to let slip some secret that they didn't know should be a secret. You know, that's not nefarious. That's just clumsy. Well, whatever is stored in a record in a database somewhere, that is something that can be queried, it can be retrieved, and if it can be queried and retrieved, it can be discovered by subpoena. Hell, the company that holds the data might even just give it away in response to a request. It's no loss to them, after all. Your privacy holds no value to them. Quite the opposite, in fact. In a fully functioning society, this is not really an acceptable status quo, but it would probably be mostly harmless. However, in a society that does not recognize a right to privacy, one that is breaking down, one that is showing cracks along the seams, this is very, very dangerous. Because just as data can be used to figure out what you'll buy, it can be used to figure out what you're doing and what you believe. Given the situation I've been talking about, I think it's very important to talk once again about operations security, or OPSEC. I kind of want to cover a couple of subtopics here, but I'm afraid I don't have all of the answers I'd like for one of them, so this may be more of a food for thought discussion than the straight up advice that I'd really like to be able to give you. Let's start by talking about if you, heaven forbid, have to travel interstate in order to obtain a medical procedure that some folks in your home state would rather that you not have. Unfortunately, I don't have all of the answers here, but here are some things that you should think about as you are planning your trip. First, as I've already said in this episode, your cell phone is a snitch. If you carry it with you, you will ideally want to keep it turned off, except when you have absolutely no option. Before you turn it off, turn on airplane mode. The reason you're doing that is so that if you need to turn it on somewhere along the way or at your destination, you'll want to make sure that it doesn't holler out your location to the network. If you can't turn it off, but you're okay with being disconnected, airplane mode's the way to do that. If you absolutely must have a working phone with you, consider getting a burner phone. You'll want this phone to be purchased with cash, running on a SIM card also purchased with cash, and that can be topped up by buying time cards at a bodega, which of course will be done in cash. Do not turn this phone on at your home under any circumstances. Do not have it and your regular phone on at the same time, at the same location, under any circumstances. Do not log into any of your social media accounts. Create new ones if you need them. And create a new Google or Apple ID when you are setting it up. In short, you're trying to make it impossible to connect this phone with you, and therefore you are creating an entirely new identity. I'd love to say, carry cash and do everything in cash. Unfortunately, this is not advice I can give in good faith. There is a history of a practice that is called civil asset forfeiture, which I believe to be a gross violation of individuals' rights, but it goes on just the same. Put simply, the police confiscate your money on the premise that if you're carrying large sums, you must be up to no good. If you do carry a lot of cash, hide it well. Perhaps a better approach would be to purchase some prepaid gift cards before your trip. Purchase them with cash, of course, and from a store that you do not frequent. If you are traveling by car, you will want to avoid toll roads. Toll roads these days operate largely by automated tolling, where your car is identified either using a radio transponder such as an Easy Pass, Pike Pass, etc., or by using an automatic license plate reader. By the way, if you do have one of those transponders, don't just not use it, leave it at home. Even when you are not on the toll roads, there are scanners that may query your transponder. As with so many things, they're not nefarious, but they're not harmless. So leave it behind you. There are probably a great deal more hazards here that also need to be addressed, but this is about all I can think of for now. If you have any suggestions that you think I should add to this advice, please drop me an email about it. The other scenario I want to discuss is if you want to go to a demonstration of some sort. First and foremost, you want to blend in. Wear nondescript clothes in neutral colors and wear a mask even if you're healthy. Bring comfortable shoes. You're going to be on your feet for a while. Bring goggles, sunscreen, and heat-resistant gloves. Carry cash for incidentals. Bring water, bring snacks. You can bring your phone if you want, but turn off biometrics and location services. If you can, bring a burner phone instead, just like if you were surreptitiously traveling. You want biometrics off because while you can't be legally compelled to give up the password or PIN, you can, plead the fifth or conveniently become amnesic, you can be compelled to unlock a phone with a fingerprint or face recognition, so just don't use those. Location services, that should be obvious. If you have no choice but to bring your main phone, consider leaving it behind instead. You might find the experience liberating anyway. Do bring your ID and memorize your emergency contact information. Obviously, do not bring drugs, weapons, or valuables. The last thing you want to do is provide an opportunity for a problem. We're getting into interesting times these days, and you're going to need to be on your toes. I wish I had something uplifting to add, but I'm very sorry, I do not. As usual, we'll end this week's show with the fail of the week. I generally try to shy somewhat away from politics in this podcast, but I think in this case that ship has sailed. So, in talking about this week's fail, I'm going to just say this. For society to be healthy, we need to have a government that is trustworthy. That doesn't mean we have to trust them, but we do have to be in a state where we could trust them if we felt so inclined. It demonstrates basic competence. So that leads us to our twin fails this week, and a demonstration that government incompetence is universal. For the first one, we go to the city of Amagasaki in Hyogo Prefecture, Japan. There, an unnamed man who was employed by a private contractor that the city had hired to oversee COVID-19 relief payments to local households got drunk one night, and he lost a thumb drive containing the personal details of around 460,000 residents. The good news here is that the content of the thumb drive is allegedly encrypted and password protected. So hopefully this is true and that they used something stronger than a zip file encryption and better password than, password. Don't laugh. I've seen it from supposedly security savvy people. For our second fail, we go to India. It seems that the Indian government has issued some confidential information security guidance to all of the government's staff. The confidential and restricted document contains a list of 24 do's and don'ts on information security, Solid advice, such as not reusing passwords, storing passwords securely, avoiding pirated software, you know, standard stuff, really. So as I said, this document was restricted and confidential, not to be distributed outside of the Indian government, so how do I know about it? Well, it's simple. It leaked. It leaked almost immediately. It really kind of reminds me of the easiest way to find manuals for RSA's products online. You find the note at the beginning of one of their manuals that says, "Please do not distribute this," and you use that as your search term. Fate, it seems, is not without a sense of irony. Little Brother is produced, recorded, edited, and hosted by yours truly, Chuck Ritter. Special thanks to Fongaboo and the crowd at Helix for web hosting support. Shout out to the Albany 2600 group. Special thanks to Knight Rider 007 and Azrael for story leads. Our headline music is Adrenochrome by Super Action 80. Our Who Got Pwnt music is Analog Summer 3 by Asarhad. Our Fail of the Week music is Space Reggae by Zap. Our opening theme music and bumper is Around Chaos by Heatseeker, and our closing theme is Space Debris by Captain Image. If you have questions or comments about this podcast or want to join the conversation, please drop me an email at critter@littlebrotherpodcast.com. Join us next week when Little Brother tells on Big Brother once again. Stay safe and be well. Let me make sure that sounds good. Was made up of millions of hacked Internets of Things devices. Audio capabilities of Ring doorbells. Doorbells. Fuck. Yes, okay, let's start it again. To facilitate blackmail, stalking, and other damaging practice. Fuck. Let's start that whole thing one more time. You can, you know, plead the fifth and complete... For the first one, we go to the city of Amagasaki, in Hyogo Prefecture. I want to read that paragraph again. Special thanks to... Fuck! I didn't put my list in there.